Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome back to the Theater Podcast, intimate personal conversations with the industry's biggest names. I am your host, Alan Seals, and this episode is with actor-choreographer Joanne M. Hunter, who is currently out now in London, working directly with Andrew Lloyd Webber on the new Cinderella musical comedy. Yeah, you heard that, right? Cinderella musical comedy. When I first heard Cinderella, I was like, great, another Cinderella. But this is an original story. It's a musical comedy, and we did a little research into the origin of the Cinderella story, and turns out Disney adapted a pre-existing story that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. So obviously, it's a story that can be adapted and made into all sorts of new things, so I'm super excited to see it. It's in previews now as I'm recording this intro, and we recorded the interview, but who knows what's going on. It may be completely open by the time this episode comes out because all of the quarantine lockdown stuff is still a little weird out in the UK. Joanne has been working directly with Andrew Lloyd Webber and the rest of the creative team to obviously, as it's been talked about so much in the news, to reopen at full capacity. They're doing previews at limited capacity, but Andrew Lloyd Webber has committed to, at least at this point again, as I'm recording this, has committed to not going to full opening of the show without a full audience. So we'll hope that that actually can happen in a safe and controlled way. Joanne didn't originally want to be a choreographer. Surprise! She has an unusual but super fun story that got her where she is now. I cannot wait to share it with you. So please take a listen. As always, before we get into the episode, find me online on Instagram and Twitter at @theater_podcast. I'm on Facebook/official theater podcast. Show your support at ttp.fm/patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Now, everybody, please enjoy this episode with Joanne M. Hunter. Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Here you go, 1, 2, 3.
Today's guest is a performer and choreographer with 20 Broadway credits and 5 U.S. national tours on her resume, including her debut in Jerome Robbins' Broadway, Miss Saigon, Guys and Dolls, Damn Yankees, Chicago, Spring Awakening, School of Rock, and most recently in Disaster, the musical. She is now across the pond choreographing the brand new Cinderella, set to open soon on the West End. Joanne M. Hunter, welcome to the Theater Podcast.
Thank you very much. I can't believe I did all those things.
Well, it's,
I was like,
just,
I did? Oh, yeah.
One step after another. I mean, I could sit here and read the entire bio, but we'd be here all day.
Oh, God, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that.
So you're actually on your dinner break right now as we're recording because you're currently in tech. Is that right?
Correct.
For Cinderella?
We're in tech. Beth, you are right. We are in, what is today? Today is Tuesday. Yes. And we our first preview is Friday. So.
Right. And we're going to get into all of this and the politics behind Andrew Lloyd Webber and the UK government. So don't think we won't cover that. But I wanted to ask if you remember this, that you and I coincidentally sat next to each other on the final show we both saw before Broadway shut down. Remember we took a selfie during Six.
Oh my God, you know, it's so, oh my God, because I'm thinking, you came on, I go, God, he looks so familiar. I know this guy. I literally, in my head, I thought, oh, maybe he reminds me of an actor. I was going to say that to you, and I thought, oh, probably everyone says that to him, so I'm not going to even say it. Oh, my God, that's right. That was the night before they were supposed to open.
Yep. Final preview you and I saw together.
That's right. Oh, my gosh. Well, it's so nice to see you under better circumstances. Well, even though we're in little boxes on Zoom, but still.
Yeah, I'm glad you remember that. Okay, so first real question then. I just want to know, what does the M stand for in Joanne M. Hunter? Hard question.
Nothing fabulous. Marie. I mean, not that it's not a fabulous name, but Marie is my middle name. And the only reason I had the initial is when I first joined Equity as a performer, you know, I joined as Joanne Marie Hunter. And then I remember my first professional job, you have to do your bio, right? And you buy your name. And I thought, oh, this is too long. Let me just write Joanne M. Hunter. And Actors Equity said, you can't. Whatever your legal name is, your professional name, that's the name that's in the bio. And I thought, oh, it's just, I have so many capitals because I have the capital J and the A and then the M and the H. And I thought, that's just too long. So I changed it to Joanne M. Hunter with Equity because I went, that's just too long. So that's the reason it's Joanne. And that's why I'm Joanne M. Hunter, basically. Nothing fancy.
It's all union rules, all this stuff. It's funny because, you know, when you look at celebrities and things too, and TV and film celebrities and their legal names, they get married and divorced multiple times and their legal names have nothing to do with their stage names in a lot of cases anymore. Right.
Right.
So, you know, you could change your legal name to anything and you'd still be Joanne M. Hunter with Equity. So
exactly.
Little known fact. A lot of people don't know that. Okay. So I want to get back to Cinderella. That's why you're out there. I was researching this and the first thing I think of when I think Cinderella is your standard story that Disney created with the glass slipper and the prince and all this stuff. But as I was
It's actually a fairy tale, I believe, in France. I think it was French fairy tale.
Yes. That's what I was getting to, is that the first recorded story featuring a Cinderella-like figure dates to Greece in the 6th century.
You're way ahead of me.
In that ancient story, a Greek courtesan named Rhodopsis has one of her shoes stolen by an eagle who flies it all the way across the Mediterranean and drops it in the lap of an Egyptian king.
Well, look at that. Isn't that something? Oh, my goodness. That I didn't know. Okay.
Yes. So the story of Cinderella has been around because I was looking at this and I was saying, oh, it's Cinderella. How are they doing something that's not the same story? But Disney doesn't own the story. Disney adapted the story like many other things. They don't own Aladdin either. Aladdin existed previous to Disney. So they don't own the name. They don't own the idea. So tell me about this version and what's going to make it different. What makes it different? Because I'm looking through my notes here. What did I say? It's a romantic musical comedy, right?
Yeah, in that way, it's very similar to the Cinderella that we all know, the R&H, you know, musical. I think when I first read the script, this was my first take on it, what I thought. What I liked about it was our Cinderella, the lovely Carrie Hope Fletcher, who plays it, who's brilliant, fabulous.
Amazing. She's amazing.
And also just a great human all around, like just and fearless, will do anything. Her character is not the, and I'm not saying this about the other Cinderellas, but it's not portrayed, nor is it written in the, oh, poor girl, poor, you know, damsel in distress, for a lack of a better way of putting it. In what it is, she is, the town that she's in, which is our town, is called Belleville, that's the town, is a very conforming, beautiful, everything is perfect, everything. And in order to be and live in this town, this is what you have to be, right? You are, and she is kind of she's basically a rebel. She doesn't want to conform. She wants desperately to be her own self. But in doing that, she herself becomes a little bit of a bully, a little bit of a pain and mean sometimes, right? So, and then the town itself, because she doesn't conform, is also very rude, for lack of, I'm just using typical adjectives and adverbs to her and about her. But what I like is that I find when people are bullying or mean or something, there's usually a insecurity.
Oh, they're covering for themselves. Yes.
Right. So I feel like Cinderella is doing that because she desperately wants to fit in, but she just chooses to go such the different route to prove something. But listen, we all want to be, we all want to belong. We all want to love, be loved. Right. I mean, we do. Right. And I think the town, the journey, what I find is that they both have the journey, both the town and her have a journey of, she has a journey that she has to be more open-minded, and they have a journey that they, she teaches them how to be, it's okay to be who you are and not have to be perfect and conform to what everyone thinks you should be, a la, you know, the days of being on a fashion magazine cover and, you know, everyone is airbrushed to an inch of their life. And listen, if you don't know that, it's true, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and we can't live up to that, but that was the main thing that attracted me to when I read the script, that I went, oh, I love that. I love that there's a reason why she's kind of like that, is because she wants to be a part of, but at the same time, because she's an outcast. So instead of trying to maybe warm yourself or being open-minded, you put up a wall, right? To protect yourself. That's, I think a lot of human beings do that. Mm-hmm. It's so that's what's different about our Cinderella and her love interest is a very different take. He also is somewhat of a, I don't say outcast, but he doesn't conform himself. It's just so, and I don't want to give too much away, but then he also has a brother who is the creme de la creme of the town. And so there's a little, but that to me, and you know, it's basically about any good story is, you know, about love and accepting who you are and accepting who other people are. And I've said this before, it's very relevant now. Unfortunately, it has been relevant forever. And I have a feeling it will continue to be relevant in the future. And you know what I mean? Until we all learn to just.
Yeah. Until until the government globally, the global government mandates health and psychotherapy for everybody. And we all learn to deal with this, you know, when we're a planet, not multiple countries. Right. It knows if it'll last that long. But I digress. Is it set in modern times?
It is. No, it's not really set. It's kind of a contemporary Baroque. That's how. It is in a make believe town and a make believe time period, but musically we're you know, we are classic, we are contemporary, we're a little bit rock, we're a little bit pop, we're all over. You know, Andrew is it's very expansive in that way. And costume wise, it is, I would say it's like couture fashion that is inspired by a period.
I like that. Okay, we'll stop there so we don't give up too much, because assuming the Delta variant just doesn't shut everything down again, I do want to take a trip soon to go see it. I haven't been out of the country. I haven't been on a plane since February 2020, which,
wow.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Speaking
of COVID and Delta variants, right? Andrew Lloyd Webber, famously in the news right now for just saying, like, giving the middle finger to the government out there and saying, I'm going to open my theaters at full capacity and there's nothing you can do about it. But yet now, okay, so things are changing daily through the magical world of podcast. Yeah, the magical world of podcast time travel. We are recording this June 22nd. In theory, you're going to hit your first preview this week, June 25th. And
right?
The full opening is going to be July 19th.
It was July 14th. It might be July 19th. Because he doesn't want to open to 50% capacity. He's like, it's got to be 100% capacity.
Right, right. So you're going to do preview. It's going to be previews that whole time. How has that been working from your side? Are you actually, like, part of the creative team? Are you actually working with him directly, or is his reps working with the show's reps, or how?
No. He's in tech rehearsal all the time. And when I say all the time, look at my face, all the time. No, it's great. You know what I mean? This is his piece. This is his creation. Also, he's put his name on the line in so many ways. As you had said, he is basically gave the finger to the government here. And you know what? Listen, this is not my homeland. This is not my home. I don't want to speak ill of somewhere that is not my, but they just had a big, this past weekend, last weekend, they had a big, the Scottish played the English in this big, you know, soccer game. Mm-hmm. From like 10:30 in the morning, they were out, there were kilts everywhere. I mean, it was like, oh, it was really cute looking. But then at nighttime, the crowd that was in Leicester Square was ridiculous. Huh. I thought to myself, really? You're going to let these inebriated bozos just spitting it on each other? But when people who go to the theater don't act that way, they're not inebriated. We're all, you know what I mean? That was one of the big things that he was really upset with this government. Like I said, I don't want to speak ill of them. This is not my homeland, but I was shocked at the crowds in Leicester. I couldn't believe it. Thank goodness my apartment is the opposite direction, so I didn't have to go through there. But I saw photos and I went, really? And yet we can open and safely to a bigger crowd. And the theaters, he's had all these filtration systems put in his theaters where it's cleaner than the air. There's no recycled air. Everything comes from the outside. So it's constantly being bad air cycled out, good air cycled in. It's unbelievable. Wow. I mean, so he has put his name and reputation on the line for this. And I have, you know, whatever you think of Andrew Lloyd Webber, if you're a fan or you're not, it doesn't matter. The fact is that he's put his money where his mouth is, or his mouth where his money is, whatever that phrase is.
Put his money where his mouth is.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. And is speaking up. And I don't know how many American producers have done that. You know what I mean? That I'm aware of. And he's been very vocal since last June, July, where he got his first vaccination shot back then.
I remember.
When I was here in August doing auditions, he was already vaccinated. So he hugged me and I had been in quarantine for 2 weeks. So he said, you and I are the safest people here. And so I was like, oh, I haven't hugged anyone in like 9 months. I was like, oh my God, you know, but you have to actually have great respect for that. For him just like, I could be all talk, but I'm not. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and he was really, he was ready to preview to a full 100% house until he found out that it wouldn't be just him that would have gotten the rest of the fine. It would have been everybody in the theater, including the patrons.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Everybody, all of us would have been fine. The cast, any front of house, everybody who worked in the theater that was in the theater and including the people who came, bought tickets would have been fined. I think it's like a 500-pound fine. So that's that's why he said, okay, I can't. Do that and you know, with feeling good about myself to put everyone else in jeopardy. So that's why. So we are previewing to a 50% capacity house, which, you know, it's better than nothing, but you know what? Musicals can't survive that way. They just can't, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about, you know, him being outspoken and compared to Broadway and another places. I feel like we've lost sight of Sydney because they've just been so normal and open and controlled that we've just forgotten that they've just been completely reopening and theaters happening and the country's relatively safe. And so there's that. There's now the Delta variant that's plaguing the UK. And in Broadway, back here in New York, I don't know. I mean, you're obviously still connected back here. I don't know how long you've been out there and been focused out there, but there's been, you say, you don't know if producers are saying the same thing out here on Broadway. I'm hearing nothing. And that's a problem too, because the wing and all of, I mean, I don't want to speak ill of these people that are obviously here in my backyard, but I wish someone would come up as an authority who isn't a governor, like someone who's part of the actual Broadway coalition, right? And to say like,
yes.
Here's what we're requiring. Here's what our safety standards are. Here's what we're going to do. Because everything has just been a reactive action from the city more or less, which
yes.
on one hand, yes, you have to do, but there are other things that you can do in the meantime that can help more things, including like you hear actors complaining about mold problems backstage, right? I was talking to a friend of mine the other day who does Broadway. She's been in lots of Broadway shows, and she's like, my allergies have never been better since I haven't been backstage. Like, there's so much to fix.
Yeah, there's, and listen, you know what? I'm not a producer. I don't know the first thing about it. I'm not interested in doing it. It's just, I don't want, but I do think that, you know, I'm digressing. This past, God, when was it? It was like late summer or fall. SDC, the Stage Director and Choreographers Union, we had this meeting, and I was asked to be on this panel, and they had a questionnaire for me, and I was talking with a fellow choreographer, and she had asked me a couple of questions, and then she goes, she said something, and I'm going to paraphrase like crazy, but basically asked me about, have you heard much from producers, or do you feel like you're well-informed? And I looked at her, because we were on Zoom, and I said, I haven't heard anything at all. I said, have you? She's like, no. I thought, I don't know. I was like, I know more about what's going on in theater here in across the pond than I know than knew what was going on in my home, in my own city, in New York City. So it was, and like I said, I know that there's a lot to deal with. I know there's a lot of money involved, especially in Broadway. On Broadway, it costs a fortune to produce. I know, I'm well aware, I've been there. But it just feels like there was no information given. There was no thought about how do we get things back? What can we do? What can we all take cuts? So I you know what I mean? As a collective group to get theater back going, to not just get it back to being put up, but also to make sure that that people that want to come back to the theater, right? Mm-hmm. And so I kept saying, why can't we have these conversations and talk? And I said, I might get killed for saying this, but I go, I am more than willing to do a compromise to get us back and going. But I said, as long as across the board that happens, and that's producers, theater owners, everyone involved has to have a compromise if we all want to collectively come back. But, and I'm not saying that's the right thing, the wrong thing. I know I might be living in a fairy tale world by saying that, but it would have been nice to maybe have that conversation or hear something. And I didn't hear a lot. Me personally, I did not hear a lot. And a lot of my colleagues had not heard anything. So, this is in a time where no one knew what to do. Anybody in modern times has not gone through this unless you're 90 something years old and lived through another plague, but otherwise or 100. So I understand this is new ground, new territory that we just don't know how to navigate. I get that. All of us do. We did. I mean, how long did you sit in your pajamas before you were like, oh, I guess this is the new normal for a while, right?
Yeah, so, the joke was like, let me wake up and roll over. Okay, now I'm at work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So I get it. I do understand. I do know it's tricky, but it is tricky times, but I think even more importantly that we've got to figure a way to come together and figure out how to make it work, like make it work for everybody so that we can come back to 100% and get jobs going. And so we can all start making money again, because God knows I'm a money whore and I want to make money.
Well, everybody needs to, obviously, in this crazy, insane city. We're going to take a short break. Stay tuned for more of the episode.
There are so many things in life that stress me out. You know what shouldn't stress me out? Eating. So we can all eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So you can choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options for all dietary needs. And you can discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and even some drinks to help you stay fueled up. Factor is also celebrating Earth Day all month long, so look out for the Earth Month's Eats badge on the menu for our lowest carbon footprint meals. Say that five times fast. Earth Month Eats. Earth Month Eats. Just remember, these no-fuss, no-mess meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, and cleaning up, so just simply heat and eat the good stuff. Head to factormeals.com/TTP50 and use code TTP50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code TTP50 at factormeals.com/TTP50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. So what are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up your springtime goals. Great
expectations. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
I'm with you, and I go back. Gosh, we are so off topic, and I love it.
I do too, actually.
I go back to the city and the government, and you know, I side with the people who are like, during this time, Broadway and the industry and actors bring in, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry for the city because of all the tourism and the restaurants and the hotels.
That's
and
right.
Everything that happens when people come to the city to see Broadway. And with all of that gone, the city was like, oh, okay, yeah, whatever. And so the fact that Broadway can't exist, I forget what the stat is now, but you can't maintain a show, the average Broadway show, if you're at like less than 80 or 85% capacity, right?
I think that's a musical, and I think a play is a little bit less, but yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. So a musical, right? So you'll say 80, worst case, right? And 80% capacity. Why is that? I want to go backwards and dissect that, and not in this conversation. I'm just saying hypothetically or rhetorically, I guess. Why can't the government subsidize some of these costs? Or why can't, you know, where does the increase come in? Where does the cost come in? Because if we can, from the top, make it less expensive to put up a Broadway show, so either that money goes to paying, you know, raise the equity minimum, get actors a little bit more in their pocket, or have it cost less. So if, you know, maybe you can apply for something. So if you operate at less than 80% for more than a couple weeks, you can get, you know, sort of like the PPP forgiveness or whatever, you know, the things that have been put in place now because of COVID. Let's put something in place with this between the city and the industry to help keep this going, because the arts, I mean, it's desperately needed. Art heals, period, right? So to get us through
completely.
This, to bring us back together, to get us to a place where we can act civilly in one, you know, in one group, right? And I talk about this on the podcast all the time. Going on an emotional journey with strangers is my spirituality. That's what we need to come back together. And the government
exactly
has the power to do this, and they're just not.
You know, and I think this is, and I, it's the same thing. I think that this is one of Andrew's complaints. It's that I don't understand why sports is better than the arts. And I'm not saying that arts is better than sports. I'm not saying that either. They both bring people together. They're both vital and important for human beings. We are animals. We are pack animals. We are not, as a group, we're not loners.
Right.
We are an animal kingdom. We like to congregate. And you need it. You need socialization, right? But I don't understand, and this is everywhere, why we don't see how important the arts is to our livelihood, not just monetarily, but emotionally, right? To everyone, whether you're in it or whether you're participating or you're voyeur and you're watching, right? I don't understand why. And the fact that some people only think of arts as theater or a movie. I was like, you turn on your Shazam or what is it, iTunes, that's music is art,
mm-hmm.
right? paintings are art, all installment. It's all art, right? Why we don't see that it is not only is it beauty, but it is a necessity. And for many reasons, like I said, for your self-worth, your self-being, but also monetarily, what it does. Broadway, the theater, I believe, is the number one revenue for New York City because of the fact it brings in tourists, which then go to the restaurants, which then see shows, which then
stay in hotels,
which then maybe go to another show, which then they'll go to another restaurant.
Go to a museum.
They'll go shopping. They'll go to museums. It's like, it is all a snowball effect. Why we don't see that is beyond me. I'm just like, well, how short-sighted are we? And this is not just America. There's a many, many places, but because I'm an American, I'm just going to say it.
Yeah. As you were saying that, I think the first thing that kind of popped in my mind was that sports, and I include esports in this now, because I live next to the Barclays Center in downtown Brooklyn, and they fill up the entire Barclays Center with Overwatch tournaments and, huge sports stadiums to watch people play video games. And that's wonderful.
But weird. I'm just going to say it. I'm sorry, but weird.
I grew up on Mario Brothers, so I don't think it's as weird.
I like playing, but I don't need to watch someone play it. I want to play it, but I don't need to watch someone play.
For me, as you were saying this, I think it's about the amount of money. It's money, full stop, I think, because is it easier to have your return on investment if you're involved with sports teams or even like esports, especially now, because there are no leagues outside of the game companies that manufacture the games also do the leagues. So they're getting money on both sides. But like the NBA is its own thing, and that obviously they don't own the companies. So esports is even a greater moneymaker. But sports, there's all of that money, and you can televise it. And that's actually a really good point now that I said that. Okay, I think I answered my own question. I was going to ask, why would you televise a sports game and not televise a Broadway show? But the answer, I think, is that you're not playing the same sports game 8 times a week.
That's right.
So that's the difference, right? You want people to come. So I think there's your answer, and I don't know how to fix this. But I think the answer then is that it doesn't have a nationally/global enough appeal to care about it like sports, like people care about sports.
Which is the saddest thing ever.
Yeah.
I mean, in metropolitan areas, yes, people understand art, that art is important. You know what I mean? Whether it's theater, whether it's music, whether it's the opera, whether it's museums, I think in big metropolitan areas, we understand that. But in the smaller places of our country, they don't. And that is a problem. And that's a problem. And I'm talking about whether you're in bumfuck somewhere. in the middle of the country where there's nothing around, where you don't have access. But how do we get access? How do we open these people, their heart and their mind to that, right? Or if you're in a big city and you're an inner city school that you can't afford it. And even in our own city, there are many little pockets where young people have no access to theater or the arts because they can't afford it, or they're not. This is a problem that we have to fix, because until we open it up and so that people can go, oh my God, this can change your life, whether you're in it or you're watching it. And just like you say, for 2 hours a night or 2.5 hours, you're taken away. Look after 9/11, right? Theater revenue was like the highest after 9/11. Mm-hmm. It was crazy. The theater brought in because we realized how important it was to be able to be taken away for two and a half hours of your night, just to not think about what just happened. Yeah. I believe Mamma Mia opened right after 9/11, right? Now, whether you think that show is brilliant or not, that's your opinion. But the fact is, for 2.5 hours, you went and you clapped and you sang songs that almost all of us knew. And you got to be able to forget. However, whatever journey that takes you on, And every show should do something different for every individual. And I, just the fact that we don't understand that doing that live is how important it is, it's even more visceral than watching it, watching a movie on TV or, you know what I mean? I just, I don't know why we don't understand that. And that stems from the top.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, it's, I mean, I guess
the government,
it's fear.
The government wants to defund the arts all the time. It is a constant fight. Blows my mind.
It's a, I think it's all out of fear, because if you televise something, then the producers who are at, who I guess would lose the most money, think people wouldn't come to see it in person. But like you just said, there's value. People still go to see their favorite, you know, the Taylor Swifts and their 49ers and, you know, all of these things. They go see them in person whenever they can, because that in-person experience cannot be beat versus watching it online or listening
it
to the album,
beat.
Whatever the case is. And maybe coming out of COVID with Diana going to Netflix and Ryan Murphy's adaptation of The Prom, and there's like 10 other movies right now that are being adapted into a film version, like In the Heights. And then there's Hamilton and Diana and others that are just the stage recording, Aladdin on the West End, right? Stage recording that's now going,
right.
That's coming out. So you've got the two versions. Maybe your answer is you should open a bar, and instead of having sports walk in, instead of having sports on every TV screen and you walk in, you have musicals on.
So you that is hey, can you turn, brilliant.
Can you turn the game on? You can be like, can you turn the Diana on? Can you turn the Hamilton on, please? It's almost there too.
God, that is hysterical. Oh my God, my brain is just like going. That is funny. That's funny. That's a funny skit. I like it. That's good.
There you go.
I can see that on SNL. That's really funny. But yeah. I mean, listen. I think it's great to see these live pieces being brought to a different format, you know. But I also am a huge believer that there is nothing that can compare, I don't care how you film it, to being in the space collectively together, everyone experiencing it slightly different. But it's the energy. It's the energy and it's the laughter. And then, you know, if you have one infectious laughter in the audience, it skyrockets, right?
And or the cast if for some picks reason, up on that. The cast
exactly.
can hear that.
Or
yeah,
if it's a
yeah.
quiet audience, it's the fact that it's different every single time it's performed. When you turn on the TV, it will not be. It'll be the exact same thing, which is great, but that's where it's a whole different, it's a different genre. And you cannot beat live theater, live music. You just can't. There's nothing that can compare to it at all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's why bootlegs. Look at bootlegs are such a big thing. And there's a reason for that, cuz people are looking for the recording of their favorite thing. Just like we can go back and watch sports games, whatever the case is. So maybe
Right.
Okay, producers, whoever's listening now, listen to this and take advantage of that market that already is there underground and monetize that. There you go.
Yeah, right.
I know you have a hard stop coming up, and I want to get into what we normally get into very much earlier on in the episode, which is just your own personal background, and we can go through the highlights. But how did you get into performing, and where did you grow up that got you where you are now?
Well, I was made in America, but born in Japan. So I am first generation Japanese American. But I grew up in Rhode Island, tiny little town called Coventry, Rhode Island, and where there were no other people that were not Caucasian besides my family. One other Japanese American family that lived two or three towns away that my father knew because they were in the war together, the fathers, and one Black family in my neighborhood. But then he left after elementary school. So I grew up in a very white place where I didn't know anything else. But I started dancing. My mother asked me, I believe I was 10 or 11, if I wanted to take ballet, because she always loved dance. And I thought, well, I don't I wasn't doing much, and I didn't have a lot of friends because I was a bit of an outsider. I was an outsider. And so I thought, sure. And luckily she found a teacher that became one of my first mentors, Nancy Lefebvre DiCicco, the name in her, Lefebvre Academy of Dance was the name of the school. And it was in West Warwick, Rhode Island, two towns over from Coventry. I started just taking ballet once a week, just, you know, because, you know, and I was a little chunky monkey. And after my first year, you know, you don't dance in the summer. And then I came back and apparently I had put on some weight because I ate a lot of popsicles. And my dance teacher even said to my mother, oh, she's gained a little weight. I was a little round pokey pokey. And then she offered, she saw potential in me. And I don't know how she did because I wasn't very good. She offered me a free second ballet class if I wanted to take tap. And I thought, okay. And so I just started taking tap. So now I'm taking three classes a week and I'm loving it. And I'm loving it for many reasons. One, because I hard to believe, but I was a shy girl because I was very insecure. But in my dance school, I wasn't different. I just was another girl dancing. That was the only thing, you know, and I felt like I belonged there. And I don't think that was something that was a conscious thing. You know, this is me thinking back, what was it? And I just felt, I felt free. I felt good about myself, you know, being in dance school. And then I just started every year, I would add on more classes until I was taking class 6 days a week. And she just took me under her wings. And like I said, what Nancy did, Miss Nancy, I called her, she also brought in teachers from all over the country and Canada. So that I was, all of her students were always, she diversified her teachers so that we got so many different styles. So that was a thing. When I moved to New York City, I could do any style. I could pick up because I was trained with so many different teachers. And she had the foresight to do that. That was somebody putting, not saying she was the only teacher that's good enough. You know what I mean? She brought in, and I didn't realize how important that was and what it did for me, you know, until years later. And then I received a scholarship. I auditioned for a scholarship to either Giordano's in Chicago or Chuck Kelly in New York City. And I chose, I was like, I don't know anything about Chicago, but I know New York is only 3 hours away from Rhode Island. So I want to go to New York, and fell in love with it. And that was the summer between my junior and senior year of high school. After my scholarship ended that summer, I came home and said to my mother that I wasn't going back to school.
Wow.
And then I was moving to New York because I thought, and New York even more, I thought I belong here because I am different. And it didn't matter because everyone was different and crazy in New York. You know, it was just there was no difference. Difference was the common. That was the common denominator, that you were unique. And I thought I don't stand out in a bad way, which I felt was a bad way, being of a mixed race. I was like, I don't stand out. We're all a little different and weird here, and everyone looks different. And I was like, to the point where I never saw anybody look different. All I saw was another human being, another girl or another boy. You know, I mean, that's what I saw. I didn't see color because the fact that we were all unique, and that's why I felt great in New York City. Didn't know anything. Didn't know anybody. I was so green and naive. But when you're green and naive, you're fearless.
I know.
And I wasn't afraid of anything back then.
And now 20 Broadway credits later, I'm sure you have experience to build on, but it doesn't sound like you should be afraid of anything because you're actually very successful. At what point did you sort of decide to go from trying to, I'll put in air quotes, you know, make it as a performer into the director, the choreography side of things?
It was not a conscious decision. I've said this before to other people that I had colleagues like Casey Nicola and Sergio. We all danced together, and Andy, you know, these great, they were all great performers and dancers. They knew they wanted to choreograph. I mean, I knew Sergio, that's what he wanted to do. Yeah. And I was like, why? I'm thinking, because when you're a performer, it is, you're a narcissist, right? It's all of you. It's just you. And I loved it. I knew, and I was very fortunate to have a very consistent career as a performer and grateful. And, but I knew I was getting a little burnt out because as most of your listeners know, that when you work on Broadway, you get 2 weeks off a year. Then that's it. And you work 6 days a week and you get 1 day off a week. I loved it. Don't get me wrong. I was like in seventh heaven. This was, oh my God, I'm on Broadway. You know, it was great, but I started to get a little burnt out, and I also went through I got a divorce from my former husband. And so it was just that there was a lot of things going on that I went, I think I need a break. And luckily I had invested well with my money and I owned an apartment, you know, so all those things, I thought I can do this. And so I just decided I don't want to do another long running show. How cocky of me. I don't want to do another Broadway show. I sound like such a dick, right? But I didn't want to get stuck being in something for a year. I was like, I thought, I'll do some regional stuff because I know those are short gigs. And I thought that'll be fun. And I was working with Rob Ashford and I was his associate in a couple of things. And I loved it. I loved it. I loved being in the studio. I loved the banter that we had. I loved creating. I loved that I still felt part of it. But I also loved that I got to go home at night after, of course, it was open, you know, thing that I got to eat dinner at a regular hour, not at 4 o'clock in the afternoon with the, you know, I was like at the blue plate specials, you know, I could have a glass of wine if I chose. When you're performing, you eat, as a dancer, you eat early because I don't want anything in my stomach when I'm performing, you know, and I enjoyed that. Even though I missed performing, I missed the camaraderie backstage. But, and then I was asked to start doing my own thing. And it was very nerve wracking for me. I thought, I'm always still nervous. I always say, I can't do this. I should be confident now. No, it's, I'm always questioning myself, but I realized I actually loved it way more than I anticipated. It was exhausting, but in a very different way. It was not physically exhausting. It was mentally exhausting.
Absolutely.
But the fact that you had your own, that I could figure out what I wanted, my own point of view in this piece. And I enjoyed it. And so I think that's really how it happened. Now, it was not a fast thing. You know, I haven't been doing this as long compared to a lot of my colleagues because I made this transition much later. And it was not easy. I'll just tell you that. Not an easy transition at all. I mean, there was 1 year that I made less money in the year than my husband paid his quarterly tax. Not kidding. I said, how much you owe? What's your quarterly that you have to pay in? And I went, I thought, that's more than I made this year. I'm not kidding. And it was not a huge amount of money, but still it was more. Thank God I had money in the bank. I didn't make any money. I was like, wait a minute. I'm thinking, I've been working all my life. I should have all the experience. Why is my paycheck getting less and less? So it was a crazy transition. It was not something I strived for or I thought that what I was going to do, but it was interesting that I had several friends and colleagues who said, oh, this is, we always knew you, this is what you should do. And I was like, really? Because I always wanted to perform. And I was like, was I not a good performer? And then I started questioning myself, like, wait a minute. So that's kind of, that's my journey was weird.
Oh, I love it. I love it because you end up, I think when you don't plan it like that, you end up where you need to be because you've taken the opportunities as they've come to you. So it's not like you're just hanging on to something that may or may not happen. You're saying yes to the opportunities that are presented. And I think I try to do that too. I have a hard time saying no for other reasons because I don't want to let people down, but I also like to experience new things and I like to go into uncomfortable situations knowing that life has taught me, right? Taught me this now, but uncomfortable situations coming out of them, you look back and you're like, wow, that was so much fun because it was different and I discovered something new that I never knew about myself. That's what I love about it. I'm going to take that
in my ear and keep, because you know what? That was really great. And that actually, that makes me feel good, because I'm always slightly weirded. I feel weird that I did not have this as part of my calendar plan. You know, I do. I always am like, oh, I know most people think that's what they want to do. And I mean, I know there are young choreographers now that they know what they want to do. But I like that. I love what you just said. I'm going to remember that. Thank you for that.
You're very welcome. All right. So let's wrap up here with three questions I ask everybody to end the episode. So these are simple, relatively. The first one, just easily, is what motivates you?
Challenge.
Oh, okay. Okay. That goes along with what we just talked about. I like it. All right. So then the second one, what advice would you give to your younger self and younger people listening now starting out down a similar path?
Oh, you know what? Diversify yourself as much as possible. Learn from as many people as you can. Take in what you like, take in what you don't like, and then figure out how to make it part of who you are.
Make yourself uncomfortable so you can be a better person. Just what we were just talking about, right? Right? Okay, this is the hardest one. The last question. If you can only see one show for the rest of your life, but you can see it as many times as you want, what would you see?
Oh my gosh. You're going to laugh at me. Oh God. The movie of The Sound of Music with Julie Andrews. What's his name? Who played Captain Von Trapp, who just passed away.
Brain fart.
Oh my God. I had a huge crush on him in the history of the whole world. For heaven's sakes, I feel like such a bozo. Oh, I'm mortified. Christopher Plummer.
Yes.
Yeah. That was the first movie musical I ever saw. And I remember I saw it in a movie theater and I was like, watching it and just, I love it. And then I asked my mother if she would buy the album and I listened to that over. Oh, I just loved her. I loved him. Edelweiss. Just don't get me. I'm just like, oh, yummy.
I love it. Oh gosh. Yeah. The first one, you never forget your first. I listened to Music Man. I watched Music Man. I wore out that VHS tape. Music Man and West Side Story. I had two firsts. Oh, that
those are good.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So where can we find you online?
Where can you find me online?
On your social medias.
Okay. I'm not on Facebook, so don't even try. I have an Instagram. I think it's Joanne M. Hunter. I'm not on it very much. I'm not very good. I try to be better, but I'm not very good. And I have a website, but it's being rebuilt.
So I noticed that. It's a nice picture on the homepage, though.
There's also a reel. There's a reel there if you scroll down.
I watched that. I'm appreciative of the a cappella music that's underscoring your reel, because I directed an a cappella group in college. I was not going.
That's awesome.
Well, you can get more of me at thetheaterpodcast.com. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at theater_podcast. Leave a rating and a review wherever you are listening. This has been edited by Well-Rounded Hoodlum Productions. Music by Jukebox the Ghost and Joanne Marie Hunter. Thank you very much. This has been so much fun. I wish we had so much longer to talk, but I know you got to go.
Me too. Thank you. This was really great. I love how different this felt. So I really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for being so much fun to talk to.
Thank you. And I'll see you hopefully in the theater, sitting next to each other again.
Yes. Let's do that.
Make the world a little colorful.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.